It's more than just words on a page, more than ink and paper. It's a universe waiting to be explored, to learn from, to laugh with, to see life through a different lens. Every story leaves its mark, and every reader leaves with a bookmark. Welcome to The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Good afternoon, I'm Batya Bricker, and this is Chai FM 101.9's Bookmark, a show dedicated to books and stories we love and the people who love them. And I know that I'm not alone. I know many of you love books as much as I do. And I'm sure you can hear from my voice that I love being on the show. I love hosting the show. I love talking about the books. But I need your guidance. I've been given the option to move Bookmark from Friday to Tuesdays at 11 a.m. In some ways, I think that might be more accessible to listeners. For all of those rushing around on a Friday, schlepping kids, cooking, etc., it might be a better time. But in other ways, Fridays feels more appropriate to chat about books. It's kind of the start of the weekend. Either way, the show will still be rebroadcast on Sundays at 11 a.m. I know many of you listen then, but please let me have your preference. Do we move Bookmark to Tuesdays at 11 a.m., or do we stay with the Fridays at 12 noon? Let me know on 061-895-1019. You know how sometimes you can get so engrossed in a book that your bath fills too quickly, the pot of pasta boils over, your routine bedtime gets ignored as you promise yourself just one more chapter? Well, today's show is dedicated to those unputdownable books, the thrillers, the mysteries, the psychological suspense novels that grip us from the first page and then refuse to let go. They are stories built on spies and espionage, secrets and lies, clues hidden in plain sight. And they keep us guessing, second guessing. And then just when we think we've worked it all out, they pull the rug from under us. A good thriller isn't just about crime or danger. It's about the tension and the pacing. It's the uncertainty of not knowing who to trust. And it's like a writer's sleight of hand, leading us confidently in one direction while quietly laying the breadcrumbs for an ending we never saw coming. Well, whether your tastes run to classic whodunits or fast-paced espionage, legal dramas, domestic noir, police procedurals, or psychological mind-benders, today's show celebrates the authors who have mastered the art of keeping us turning pages long after we should have turned out the lights. So settle in and lock the doors, ignore the suspicious creaks in your house, and let's explore the delicious world of thrillers and page turners, where nobody is quite who they seem, and sleep can always wait until tomorrow.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and this is Chai FM 101.9's Bookmark, a show dedicated to books and stories we love and the people who love them. I need your guidance. I've been given the option to move Bookmark from Friday to Tuesday at 11 o'clock. In some ways, I feel that it might be more accessible to listeners if it was on a Tuesday. But in other ways, Fridays just feels like a book day, a great day to chat about books. But either way, the show will still be rebroadcast on Sundays at 11 a.m. I know many of you listen then. But please let me have your preference. Do we move Bookmark to Tuesdays at 11 or stay with Fridays at 12 o'clock? Let me know on 061-895-1019. Today we are talking thrillers, page turners, those unputdownable books that keep you reading way after bedtime. And one of the key features of this genre is that the stories don't always end with a final page. Many of the best thrillers come in series. So it means that once you've discovered a detective or an investigator or an unlikely hero that you love, it becomes surprisingly easy to become hooked. Before long, you're not just reading a book, you're following a life. You're returning to a familiar character as they tackle new mysteries and face fresh dangers, and you learn a little bit more about them each time. And there's something satisfying, I think, that when you've just finished one breathless adventure, another is waiting in the wings on the shelves. So to start, I wanted to touch on two characters who, for me, feel so alive and so real and kind of like my friends. The first is Daniel Silva's Gabriel Allon. The newest Daniel Silva book is called Ransom, and it's just released. It is number 26 in the Gabriel Allon series. So there's plenty of fodder to feed your obsession if you do, in fact, fall in love with Gabriel Allon, and I certainly did. In this thriller, the art restorer and retired spy is tasked with finding a missing British socialite, which drags him back into a perilous world alongside an old enemy. The Gabriel Allon phenomenon, because that's what it's become called, features this reluctant Israeli intelligence operative, ex-Mossad, who operates as a world-renowned art restorer. So for me, that combination of Mossad and art is just irresistible. And of course, throw in that Gabriel is no doubt gorgeous and brooding and deep and a little bit broken. It's really, he makes for an amazing and unforgettable character. The series stands out from traditional spy thrillers because unlike classic amoral spies, Allon is driven by duty to his homeland, which, you know, resonates so strongly for us. And his quiet life as an art restorer is like the perfect foil and psychological escape from his dark history. And I think that the nature of Israel and Israelis, that is how they live. And so it is really resonant, now more relevant than ever. The books in general are highly synchronized with global events, so the series tackles geopolitics and the war on terrorism and the rise of Vladimir Putin and, of course, the sadly ever-current conflict in the Middle East. But for me, what makes this special is the integration into the art world, and there is so much of Venice and Italy in these stories, even as you skate across the world fighting evil, and you still come back to Italy and it's beautiful art. Allon's expertise in restoring Renaissance and Impressionist masterpieces is, I think, a unique backdrop. And you have stolen artwork and high-stakes auctions and illicit financing featuring heavily in the plot. My preference is for the early Gabriel Allon books because they focus so much more on Venice and the city and the art. But for those who want a more contemporary feel and some chillingly close parallels to today's political climate, the newer ones are your better bet. I think that they have changed with the nuance in global politics and the change in current affairs with Israel in particular. And so it's interesting to call it would be interesting actually to revisit those early ones, I think, and kind of get a sense of how things have changed or perhaps they have not. Thank you for your responses. I would love to hear from more of you because I need to know. I have been given the option to move Bookmark from Fridays to Tuesdays. And it's now Fridays, 12 o'clock, and the suggestion is to move it to Tuesdays at 11 o'clock. In some ways, it would be more accessible on a Tuesday, and in other ways, Fridays feels more appropriate for books. So either way, the show will be rebroadcast on Sundays at 11 o'clock. Please let me have your preference. Do we move Bookmark to Tuesdays at 11 or stay with Fridays at 12? Let me know on 061-895-1019. I've only just recently been introduced to Detective Chief Inspector Max Ryan from the smash hit DCI Ryan Mystery Series. And I have to say that I am hooked. There are 24 books in this series, so this is a series that's going to see me through. You have a handsome hero in the brooding, dedicated detective, Chief Inspector Max Ryan, and he is surrounded by loyal, quirky team members, sidekicks, and it focuses very heavily on this tight-knit bond of friendship and community. The appeal of L.J. Ross's book series is combining these gripping, fast-paced murder mysteries with atmospheric, real-world British settings. And in fact, her books have been touted as a love letter to the UK, especially Northeast England and Northumberland. And if you're a fan of Vera, that's Anne Cleves Vera, or Shetland, it's that landscape. It's a very similar, desolate, beautiful, kind of wild experience of the UK. They are still fast-paced. The thrillers are intensely addictive and bingeable. And what's quite nice, though, is that there's a touch of romance and emotional resonance as well. So the first one I read was Holy Island, which was the first one. And that's what I fell in love with. And the latest book is DCI's, in this mystery series, is called Berwick. And it's just been released, the 24th, and marks a full circle milestone of the beloved Northumbrian detective stories. I highly suggest you try at least one and see if you get hooked.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and today on Bookmark, we are talking spies, espionage, covert operations, the kind of fodder that makes for page-turning, unputdownable thriller fiction. And I'm delighted to welcome to the show David McCloskey, the Sunday Times best-selling author of The Seventh Floor, Moscow X, Damascus Station, and now The Persian. He is also the co-host of a podcast called The Rest is Classified. And if spies and espionage are your thing, then this is an absolute must listen. David, a very warm welcome.
Batya, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
David is a former CIA analyst. And while at the CIA, he wrote regularly for the president's daily brief. Can you imagine? Delivered classified testimony and briefed senior white officials, ambassadors, military officials, and Arab royalty. He's advised national security, aerospace, and transportation clients on a range of strategic and operational issues. There's a rather delicious and long tradition of espionage insiders turning their hands to fiction, as if the world of secrets simply refuses to stay contained. Think Ian Fleming, who worked in British Naval Intelligence, famously transforming his experience into the iconic James Bond. And there's also Frederick Forsyth, whose proximity to intelligence work and global politics gave his novels, like The Day of the Jackal, a chilling sense of precision and plausibility. And what these writers share is an ability to straddle two worlds, the seen and the unseen, the public narrative that we see, and then the hidden machinery behind it. And what makes them feel authentic is because not just of what they know, because they understand how much is never said. And in that sense, when former insiders like David McCloskey step into fiction, they're not just telling stories, they're translating a reality most of us will never glimpse. So before we get to the books, David, I have to ask how you became a CIA analyst. How does that happen to you?
Well, I wish I had a sexier story or a lie ready for you. To make this sound more glamorous, but the reality of it is that a recruiter showed up on my university campus when I was 19 and gave a talk to my International Relations 101 class. And at the time, I had really two things on my CV. I had dug holes for a sprinkler system company, and I had made burgers at the fast food chain Wendy's, which I'm not sure if you have here in South Africa.
We know Wendy's.
You know Wendy's. And so I thought, you know, the CIA would be a bit of a step up from those two opportunities, and why not give it a shot? And I, of course, never thought that I would actually make it in. But I applied kind of like you would for a normal job. You know, I submitted a writing sample. I did an interview and went through the entire process, which, you know, eventually involves polygraph, medical exam, psychological exam, and wound up becoming an undergraduate intern at the Central Intelligence Agency, which is actually a job that they have. So I started when I was 20. I walked into Langley for my first summer as an intern and didn't look back. It was a wonderful job.
Was it a wonderful job?
It was.
Did you love it?
I did. It's very, you know, I wanted to study international relations because I had a sense that I wanted to travel the world and live in some places that were outside of the United States, and ultimately wanted to understand a bit more of how the world actually worked. And the CIA, because it's in the business of stealing state secrets, is a great place to understand how the world actually functions. What do people inside government actually think? How do governments actually interact? What do they do? How do they lie to one another? The kind of reality of it, which sometimes is not so pleasant, was still really fascinating to me. So the CIA was a great place to get that window into how the world actually works.
And if we were to follow you for a day now, would we find small spy-like habits? Like, are you reading the room? Are you always looking at people in a different way? Or have you left that world behind?
I maybe should do more of it. I think if you followed me for a day now, you would see me spending large chunks of it staring at a blank computer screen, attempting to write fiction. You know, I do think that an awareness of your surroundings and the people around you and a sort of a sense of your place and atmosphere, like, that doesn't really leave you. Although, honestly, you know, most days I'm not really thinking about that, right? I'm doing things that, you know, to most people would look maybe quite normal for
quite
an author.
Ordinary, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know, though, if you ever lose that hyper-awareness. You may not be even realize that you are actually noting things that perhaps the everyday person isn't.
I think that's right. I do think that's right. And a lot of, you know, a lot of what I talk about in the novels is the kind of fairly mundane but real tradecraft of the way, you know, CIA case officers interact with the world, interact with their agents, their assets. And a lot of that is taking stock of a tremendous amount of detail and keeping it in your brain. So it's not car chases, you know, it's not a lot of gunplay or anything like that. It's understanding the world around you, understanding people. And that's the reality that I try to bring to life in these books, in particular in The Persian.
What a life to have lived. There's a kind of, not a formula, but essential ingredients that go into a good thriller. You need an epic battle of good versus evil. You need power versus truth. Throw in maybe a car chase or a shootout. You need some
hurt,
of that,
yeah.
Yes. But what struck me about your book, and The Persian in particular, is the moral complexity that you explore. Because I'll be honest, I'm very much on one side of the fence in a story like this. But they're no easy heroes or villains, and good and evil kind of blur. And you get a sense that anyone who works or lives or dies for a cause, whether you believe in it or not, they believe they're on the side of good and right.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage this when you write your books?
Well, I think, number one, I don't know many people, you know, just in my everyday life, who are all good and all bad. Nobody's really like that. And when you drift into that world in thrillers of cartoonish good guys or bad guys, I think you lose, at least I lose readers, or I lose myself as a reader, because I don't feel that it's authentic. I think that your point about people is well taken, because people who are doing evil in any context don't think that they are.
I'm sure not.
You know? And so when I write these characters, and, you know, I think when I am putting a book together, I'm not really thinking about who's the good guy and who's the bad guy as I write. I'm thinking about two people or more who want very different things. And what will they do? What lengths will they go to get those things? I think that's really interesting, because it allows, you know, it frankly allows me to strip aside any of my own, what I think the morals or ethics of a particular conflict are, or particular behaviors, and just say, let's ground this story in authentic people on either side of a conflict. And in this case, what I tried to do was build an authentic, as best I could, an authentic portrayal of, well, how do Mossad officers see this shadow war with Iran? How do they think about it? You know, what do they think about what they do? And on the Iranian side, the same. What do Iranian security officials think about this? And how do they behave? And so it's not an attempt in any sense to draw moral equivalence or to tell the reader what they should think about this conflict, but it's an attempt to authentically draw those characters, set them in motion, and hopefully create an interesting and propulsive story that also does make people think about this conflict without giving them clear answers.
Yeah. It must be very challenging, though, to park your own emotions and your own views, particularly in something that is so current. This isn't history, really. I guess it's focusing on the humanity of your characters, which gives you the ability to do that.
The way I write is I start with a setting. And in this case, I wanted to do a novel in the middle of the Israel-Iran shadow war. There's a lot to work with for a spy novelist. When you find characters who exist in the context of that conflict, it's a relief as a writer, because what I think about it kind of doesn't matter. I'm just trying to write. I'm trying to find the voice of those characters. Good, bad, somewhere in between, you know, evil, nasty, angelic, whatever they might appear as. Like, I just want to write those characters to be authentic. And if I write those characters with an authentic voice and find that voice and tap into it, I will not have to, you know, sort of push my own view about whatever geopolitical conflict I'm writing about into the novel, because the characters will do that work. And I think we, when we read fiction, or when I read fiction, if I feel that the author has sort of intruded with a moral lesson, it doesn't work for me, because it feels so outside the bounds of good storytelling. Good storytelling should happen through the lens of the characters, their experiences, their desires, and it's kind of it.
Yeah, the reader has to decide.
The reader has to decide.
The reader has to decide. The Persian takes readers into this shadow war between Israel and Iran, and it's two places that are so often reduced to headlines. Do you feel a responsibility in portraying these places as more than just headlines?
Absolutely. Yeah. This journey for me as a writer really started with my first novel, which is called Damascus Station. It's set in the Syrian Civil War. It was really, really important to me because I worked on Syria as a CIA analyst. I lived in Damascus. And I felt like a lot of the commentary on that conflict was just oversimplified, or people just ignored it. They said, it's too complicated and crazy and weird, and what do we care? I don't want to pay attention to it. And I do think in Israel-Iran conflict, it's very similar, where you can, depending on your experience, your politics, you could decide before you ever open this book, based on news headlines you've read, hey, you know, I've picked a side, or I know exactly who the good guys are and bad guys are. And I think that I'm trying to challenge our sort of oversimplified mental models of the world with these kind of books, because you do get into the head of different characters. And so even if you don't come out of this novel thinking, and I don't think any reader would come out of this novel thinking, man, I'm really supportive of what these Iranian security officials are doing, because they do some really nasty stuff in this novel. But you would at least come out of the novel with a much more nuanced understanding of both what the world looks like from Tehran and what it looks like from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. And I hope that readers, no matter where they kind of come down or if they do, that they'll see a much more complicated and textured picture of the world, because that's actually what the world is. It's not an oversimplified mental model. It's millions and millions of people having different experiences about the world, you know, from different perspectives, depending on the country they may have grown up in, or multiple, you know, in Iran, there's not one perspective in Iran. There's not one in Israel. So I'm trying to fill the book with that kind of complexity.
I certainly got that. And as I said, I was very much on one side of the fence, but it became a little gray, you know, people are good and bad. Things that governments do, armies do, you know, it's good and bad. It's not quite so simple. The Persian is about a Swedish Jewish dentist of Iranian origins who becomes a Mossad operative in Tehran. And in your acknowledgments, you mention needing guidance to navigate the nuances of Swedish culture from your American perspective. I'd love to hear some of examples where these cultural gaps showed up for you. But I also wanted to ask you if you needed that for Israel and Iran too.
I needed it for everything in this novel. I think as I, you're right to sort of point out the character of Cam as the protagonist of the novel and is the, you know, he's the Persian. So as I was writing his character, it got more and more complicated because I had, you know, he's Persian, sort of. He grew up outside of Iran. And so he's not exactly looked at as, you know, a native Iranian, even though he is. He's Swedish, kind of. You know, a lot of Swedes don't think he's Swedish. He's Jewish, not really practicing, not an Israeli, has never been to Israel when the book opens. And so there's a lot of layers there, which as a writer is really interesting, but also from a research standpoint, may have been a mistake because I had a lot of work to do.
You set yourself up, right?
I set myself up for kind of a mess because you can only hear my voice, but I am none of those things. I'm not Jewish. I'm not Persian. I'm not Swedish. I'm not Israeli.
This is going to be tricky.
I had to do some real research, and I definitely had to do it. I mean, I spent the vast majority of my research in this novel was either on my Israeli side, the Israeli characters, or on the Iranian characters. And Cam's obviously a blend of those things. But he has grown up for much of his life in Sweden, as you mentioned. He is a dentist. He's a Swedish dentist. And so I had to get, and there are a number of scenes that take place in Sweden because his entire, you know, sort of immediate family is in Stockholm. And what I found was, well, you can't, you know, I was kind of hoping I can just copy paste American culture into Sweden. And it turns out that's not true. I had a number of readers who are Swedes or who are living in Sweden who helped me with things like the food, the very kind of interesting Swedish relationship with alcohol. With what a sort of elder care assisted, you know, living facility would look and feel like, how, you know, a Swedish dentist's practice would be set up. I actually had a Swedish dentist help me with the novel, which was great because I have a scene in here where Cam is looking into the mouth of Eric Glitzman, who is his Mossad handler, and is thinking about how Eric Glitzman has been grinding his teeth from all the stress. And he's looking at the teeth as a dentist would, and he's thinking about them in terms of their numbers. And I had used the American numbering of teeth. And I sent the chapters to the Swedish dentist, and he came back and was like, we don't use those numbers in Sweden. You got the numbers wrong. And so there's all these little things when you're writing a novel where you actually have to start questioning every little detail you put in there, because in Sweden, in Iran, in Israel, it could be totally, totally different. So I do enjoy learning. And so I find this process to be quite fun, but it also can get to a very maddening point because you're creating an entire world in these novels. And that's all the way up to Israeli and Iranian sort of security policy, all the way down to, you know,
numbers
Swedish
of teeth
dentistry.
In Swedish mouths. That's I want right. to know what their teeth are like.
I know. I think Swedes have pretty good teeth.
Have great teeth. Well, then maybe we should be looking at that. I'm kind of feeling like, as a writer, it must be quite daunting because you can get tripped up at any point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As you say, from really big questions to the number of teeth in a mouth. You are talking about regions and cultures in your book that are very close to most of our listeners' hearts. And, of course, very much in the global spotlight. Politically charged, emotionally complex, often deeply polarizing, even within families. Do you think that the events of Iran and Israel that are currently happening, do you think that it's affected how people have read your book now? Did it impact the writing at all?
This most recent round did not, because the book was done and printed and all that. And it was even off to the printer last summer. During the 12-day war and Operation Midnight Hammer, it was done and locked. And so there could be no reference to any of that. As I was writing, though, there were a couple rounds of, I think there was an attack on the Iranian, an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And then there was a volley of ballistic missiles and drones from Iran into Israel as I was writing. And so I knew as I was writing that that wasn't going to be the end. There was going to be a lot more of this. And so I wanted this novel to speak to the current situation, no matter what happened. But I knew I couldn't. It would have been absolute folly to have tried to get in front of it, predict it in some way. That just wasn't going to work. And so I purposely, you know, there aren't scenes in this novel with the Israeli prime minister. There aren't scenes in this novel with the Iranian supreme leader. And because I had a feeling, it's like, well, there could be changes of government in Israel. There could, who knows what's going to happen in Iran. At the time, I was thinking less about him being killed and more about the fact that he's very old and could potentially die. And so I purposely took this novel down a couple levels so that you wouldn't pick it up and think, oh, it's dated.
Yes. It's no longer relevant.
Right. And you know, my earlier novels, like Damascus Station, there's a scene with Bashar al-Assad. Moscow X, there's a scene that has Vladimir Putin in it. The Seventh Floor, my third novel, has a scene with Putin in it. This one was a conscious choice, just given how volatile it is, to keep it at this kind of shadow war level. Because even if the conflict spills into the open, as it has recently, this kind of below the surface clandestine conflict is still going on. And it's going to be going on after, you know, if we get a deal to end this current round. So I hope that the novel, again, it's not meant to predict, but I do hope that when you read it, you think, I'm getting some understanding of this conflict and what's going on beneath the surface in this kind of world that none of us really see.
I think that it's such a layered, complex, complicated situation that understanding even just one more layer is really useful, because whatever's happening in the current time is a product of what has come before it. Well, our turbulent times are certainly as strange and entertaining and nail-biting as your fiction. David, thank you for joining us. I think I could speak to you all day, and there are a whole lot of questions I'll be asking you offline. But for now, thank you very much for joining us.
Bhatia, thanks for having me.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Bhatia Bricker.
Welcome back. This is Chai FM's Bookmark, and I am Bhatia Bricker. I asked you, and so you answered. Thank you for letting me know if you prefer the book show on a Friday, the slot at 12 o'clock, or Tuesday at 11 a.m., which is the other option we have. If you haven't had a chance to let me know, please do on the WhatsApp line 061-895-1019. But for now, thank you, Priscilla, for your compliments for the show. And it sounds like you're a bit more flexible. You don't mind which time slot at all. But there are others who feel very strongly about Friday. Friday, I know, Eric, you mentioned Friday. Marcel, you asked for Friday. Ruth, I'm so glad you're enjoying the show. And you'd also prefer a Friday. I've also received various private messages on my phone saying, please, Friday, with capital letters. So it looks like Friday is in the lead. But back to our show for now. And I wanted to talk more about the whodunit genre, because it is my favorite. I am a huge Agatha Christie fan. She was the queen of the golden age of crime. And there are many books that have been inspired by her legacy and her style of writing. And one of them is David Horowitz's series that features Susan Ryland. And if you haven't met Susan Ryland yet, you are in for such a treat. It's the whole series is part of this current trend of unlikely and reluctant amateur sleuths who solve crimes even when their day job is something completely different. And Susan Ryland's day job is that she's an editor. She's an editor and sometimes publisher. And so obviously I relate directly to her. I simply adore the very real publishing world that Horowitz so deftly and accurately portrays. What he does is he nests a mystery within a mystery. So her storylines cleverly toggle between the present-day publishing world and then the 1950s whodunits that were written by her eccentric authors, and in particular Atticus Punt. She is definitely inspired by Agatha Christie and Arthur Conan Doyle, but it's this dual structure, I think, that makes it so fresh, and the clues that Susan uncovers helps her solve real-world murders surrounding the authors that she works with. So the first book in the series is Magpie Murders, where she's a successful book editor working for Cloverleaf Books, and her top-selling but very difficult author, Alan Conway, dies under suspicious circumstances. And she finds that the final chapters of his latest Atticus Punch mystery manuscript are missing. So she's forced to play detective simply for the sake of the book, but realizing along the way the clues of Conway's real murder hidden inside his own book. The following one was Moonflower Murders, and it followed that, and it was after the stressful events of the previous book. Susan goes on to Greece to run a hotel with her boyfriend and to run her editing consultancy from this exotic and glorious location. I think this is possibly the dream of any editor, writer, or anyone in the book world. So it's very relatable. And of course, there's a mystery, a disappearance of a wealthy couple's daughter, and tied to a murder at an exclusive hotel years prior. And then the last one is Marble Hall Murders, and it's the third and final installment, where Susan is hired by publishers to expand on the late Alan Conway's Atticus Punch series. And it puts her back into a dangerous web of real-world vendettas and literary puzzles. This show, these mysteries, are also on Netflix. And I think they actually every bit as good as the books. And if you're interested in fashion and clothes, Susan also wears the most gorgeous and interesting outfits in every scene. So it's an absolute treat. The last series I wanted to touch on was by Ruth Ware. Now, she doesn't have one character or one investigator across all her books. But I came across Ruth Ware unexpectedly, because I am an Agatha Christie fan. And in about 2022, a book was published called Marple. And it was 12 short stories written by contemporary authors about Miss Marple. And they imagined her in a slightly more modern day setting. And they took on the persona of Agatha Christie, and it was written in the style of Agatha Christie. Well, I've read and reread Marple many, many times. They're short stories, so they're glorious to read and to kind of dip into. And it was a great honor for any author to be asked to be part of the series and to write a book on Marple, Miss Marple is my most favorite character of all time. But that is true. She is one of the most famous characters in the world of literature altogether. So it was a great honor. And one of those people was Ruth Ware. She is an international number one best-selling author. And she's got best-selling books kind of on all best-selling lists all over the world, including Sunday Times and the New York Times, and she's published in more than 40 languages. The book that I read is not a new one, but I read it recently on a trip, on the aeroplane, and I gobbled it up. It's called The Woman in Cabin 10, and it's about Lo Blacklock, who is approached by a desperate woman asking for help. And it starts this white-knuckle race across Europe, and I could not put this down. So I highly recommend you look at Ruth Ware. But for now, from our sponsors, Thursdays and Fridays mean fresh magic at the Family Bakehouse. Golden challahs, babkas, biscuits, and cakes baked in small batches and with no shortcuts. Perfect for Shabbat or the weekend. Find the Family Bakehouse at Genesis, Aurochs, and selected distribution centres.
Turn the page. It's The Bookmark with Batya Bricker.
Welcome back. I'm Batya Bricker, and this is Bookmark. I hope that you have enjoyed today's show. It was all about the thrilling page turners that once the spine is cracked open, you simply can't put down. So we met Daniel Silva's Gabriel Allon in that series. We met Detective Chief Inspector Max Ryan in the L.J. Ross series. And we met Susan Ryland in Anthony Horowitz's Murder Mysteries. We also interviewed the ex-CIA analyst David McCloskey, who was the author of The Persian and Damascus Gate and various others. So I hope that you have enjoyed each slot. Each of these offer so incredible fodder for reading and for getting hooked, which is what you want to do. I asked you if we should be moving the show to Tuesday at 11 o'clock, which is another option for us. But it seems that so many of you have said Friday is the day. Elaine, I'm so glad that you love the show. I do put in a lot of research and effort, and I'm so glad that it lands well and that you are enjoying the fruits of that. And Fridays, please, with lots of exclamation marks, is noted. That's noted. Mavis, thank you for your input also. Friday, votes for Friday. And so it seems like the tribe has spoken. I think Friday is the right day for the show. Please keep listening. Please keep engaging. I would love to hear what you're reading at any time. You can send through your messages, and I will. It just also informs me and tells me what you're reading, what you want to hear more of, who you want to hear more of. So thank you for listening, and keep listening, enjoy, and until next week, Friday, goodbye and happy reading.